This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Good evening and welcome to the final today in Parliament before the election with me, Susan Hume, and Mark Darcy. We're here in the central lobby of Parliament as MPs scramble to clear their desks and say their goodbyes before heading back to their constituencies for the campaign. After that, Westminster will fall almost silent until the 19th of June and the state opening of a new Parliament.
I'm Mark Darcy and I've been speaking to four MPs about the highs and lows of what turned out to be a brief but very dramatic Parliament.
Anything that allows people to see that somehow or another when you become an MP you don't just depart the human race, it's got to be good.
And there's some last-minute business too. Labour presses the Brexit Secretary on the status of EU nationals.
Is that how they are going to deal with the anxiety? Don't apply.
Also, the government admits it made a mistake about the places available for child refugees. And Parliament finishes up or prorogues with new laws and a traditional blast of Norman French.
Homelessness Reduction Act.
La Reine Revolt.
But first, as EU ministers meet to hammer out their final Brexit negotiating position, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that people in the UK should have no illusions. Our future relationship with the European Union, for example on trade, could not be discussed until more immediate matters were settled first. Those issues include how much the UK should pay to settle up its budget bill with the EU and the future status of EU citizens currently living in Britain. In the Commons, Labour's Brexit spokesman Sir Keir Starmer argued that the situation of EU nationals was one matter at least that could be cleared up easily.
Around 3 million EU nationals are very anxious about their status when we leave the EU. Labour would unilaterally guarantee their status from day one. Under this government, all they can do is apply for consideration for permanent residency.
A Commons committee has criticised the system for applying for permanent residency. It involves an 85-page application form and lots of supporting documentation. But the Brexit Secretary, David Davis, insisted people didn't need to worry about applying by that route.
The system that's there now is not designed to deal with 3 million people, and it's been made plain. In fact, if you go on the Home Office website, you'll see them saying, don't make application now, you don't need to. And when we actually move the primary legislation, it'll be a matter for the Home Office, but I believe that it will be very simple when we come to that point.
Sir Keir Starmer seized on that advice.
The Home Office is now saying, don't apply. Is that the official government position for EU nationals? Don't apply for permanent residency. Is that how they are going to deal with the anxiety? Don't apply.
Well, David Davis didn't want that to be misinterpreted.
What that is about is the Home Office. It's a reflection of what's on the website, which is essentially pointing out they don't need to apply for their rights to be underpinned, and that's the approach we're taking. Bear in mind, for the next 2 years, irrespective of anything the government does, all of the existing rights and privileges continue to apply. There will be no change in that respect.
Labour's Chuka Munna seized on Theresa May's claim that she'd called the general election to unite Britain and strengthen her EU negotiating hand, arguing that she'd been behind a string of divisive policies.
This is the government who, with its hard Brexit allies, seeks to call anyone who calls into question their negotiating strategy a bunch of saboteurs. Yeah. Is not the truth that far from uniting this country, this Tory government and its ministers have been dividing it since they took office?
The Conservative Peter Lilly said the government was right to try to keep the current free trade arrangement with the European Union. It would be best for the UK and the EU as well.
They, however, cannot admit what I think is quite likely, that politics may trump economics and there may be no deal. Can they therefore confirm that in those circumstances we will go to a good second best, which is trading on most favoured nation terms, as do the European Union's most successful partners?
And he argued that a 4% tariff on goods would be outweighed by the advantages. The Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson said this morning that he stood by the claim on the side of his EU referendum battle bus that leaving would mean £350 million more each week for the NHS. Labour's Heidi Alexander still wasn't convinced.
Far from there being an extra £350 million a week to be spending on the NHS following Brexit, we are likely to face an NHS staffing crisis and slower access to cancer drugs and treatments because of the loss of the European Medicines Agency. Is the Secretary of State going to be putting that sign on a bus in the next few weeks?
Move on, called one Conservative at the end there. And David Davis said he wasn't going to revisit the arguments of the past, but work instead on delivering the best outcome for the future. Now, the government has admitted that it made a mistake over the number of local authority places available for child refugees in England. It turns out that, thanks to an administrative error, there are 130 more places than previously thought. The Labour peer Lord Dubs, who's campaigned for more children to be admitted, forced a statement in the Lords, as Mandy Baker reports.
Lord Dubs successfully secured the original commitment to take child migrants. His amendment to the Immigration Act required the government to accept refugee children who had reached Europe unaccompanied. Campaigners had wanted far more children to be settled here than the 350 ministers were willing to accept. But it's now emerged that that figure was an underestimate, and there are in fact 480 places available. Lord Dubs said he was pleased more children were now being taken in.
Even if the reason is the Home Office having to hang its head in shame because they made an administrative error as part of collating the figures. That comes out of Yes Minister.
According to a written statement, an offer from one local authority to take 130 children had not been taken into the calculations. The Home Office Minister, Lady Williams, apologised for the error.
200 children have been taken so far, so we haven't even got to the 350. So I wouldn't want noble lords to think that any child had been disenfranchised because of this administrative error, which is, as I've said, most regrettable.
Her Labour opposite number, Lord Rosser, thought the matter had been badly handled.
I think it would have been better if the government had come with an oral statement to the House on this issue rather than putting it in a written statement just before we're about to cease sitting. This is an issue of considerable interest to the House.
Lord Dubs believed there was now an opportunity to take even more refugee children.
Will the government now reconsult local authorities? Because there are many local authorities, not just in England, but in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, who have expressed a willingness to take more child refugees. And is the Minister not aware that many representations have been made recently about the availability of local authority places?
The Minister insisted the government had consulted local authorities.
I know that the Immigration Minister wrote to all local authorities. A national launch event was held and over 10 regional events were held in every part of England, as well as one in Scotland and one in Wales.
A Liberal Democrat, Lady Sheehan, suspected that more clerical errors may emerge, and she criticised ministers for acting too slowly.
Will the government accept that we have a moral and legal duty to these children and reopen the Dubs scheme to ensure that these errors are ironed out once and for all and that we do act with utmost haste in bringing these unfortunate children to the UK?
Lady Williams replied that the Dubs scheme had not been closed. A Conservative, Lady Mansour, said her main concern was for people who had not reached Europe.
The most vulnerable children and women are still in Syria and on the borders of Syria. Yeah. And can the my noble friend the Minister say what support the government has given in this vital work?
The Minister said £2.4 billion was earmarked for aid in the region.
Mandy Baker reporting. The government's seen off an attack in the Lords over its plans to replace nurses' training bursaries with student loans. Labour's Lord Clark put forward what's known as a motion of regret. He explained what the changes in England would mean for student nurses. They'd have to pay £9,000 a year in fees for 3 years.
Which, with their living costs, mean that the nurses enter a profession not well paid, with £50,000 minimum hanging on their shoulders. And I don't think that is a very sensible way of approaching it.
Lord Clark summed up the government's stance.
They're actually insisting that the nurses pay for working in the health service. They're paying their £9,000 a year to work as unpaid nurses. And I think that is actually scandalous. Yeah. Absolutely scandalous. Yeah.
An independent peer, Lady Watkins, said she believes she was the only registered nurse in the Lords, though she's now an emeritus professor in healthcare. She felt nurses' starting salaries needed to be raised.
To recognise that they will be expected to repay their student loans as from 2020. As a woman, I get very fed up with hearing both in this house and in the other house that very few nurses will have to pay back much of their loan because they don't earn very much. That is not the right approach, I believe.
The Conservative former minister, Lord Willetts, though, insisted the new system would be a great improvement.
It delivers more money per nurse for universities providing nurse education through the fees and loan system. And it removes the cap, so provides the NHS with more trained nurses in total. That is a constructive reform for the NHS. It is progress.
But the Liberal Democrat, Lady Walmsley, argued that the prospect of fees was more likely to deter would-be nurses than other students.
They are more predominantly from lower socio-economic groups, and they have a higher proportion of mature students with family commitments. They spend nearly half their course time in supernumerary placements in hospitals and have a higher number of contact hours and weeks than other students. And that makes it more difficult for them to get a part-time job.
The Minister, Lord O'Shaughnessy, said funding nurse training through student loans rather than bursaries would enable over £1 billion more to go into funding the NHS. The change would also mean there'd be more nurses in the future, and the opposition parties were wrong to oppose it.
They are wrong because the new system we are introducing for student nurses matches that experienced by other undergraduate students, a system which has been the primary driver of the big expansion of higher education and improved participation among disadvantaged young people.
And when it came to the vote, peers backed the government by a majority of 38. You're listening to Today in Parliament here on BBC Radio 4 with me, Susan Hume, and with Mark Darcy, who joins me now.
Today marks the end of a short but extraordinary Parliament. There have been two moments of horrific violence, the murder of Joe Cox and the terror attack last month. It's only been 2 years since the last election, but the Westminster landscape's changed out of all recognition. Parliament's been overridden by the EU referendum, so now MPs and peers have to back Brexit, which most of them didn't actually support. It took a court case by a member of the public, Gina Miller, to ensure that Parliament could vote on triggering Article 50. Well, to reflect on all this, I brought together four MPs, the Conservative Alistair Burt, Labour's Meg Hillier, the SNP MP Deirdre Brock and the Liberal Democrat Alistair Carmichael. I asked Alistair Carmichael what he'd made of these sometimes dizzying twists and turns.
Events, dear boy, events. And, you know, we can sit here and try and plot a way through from our own various experience, but frankly, there are going to be days when everything we think we know are going to be blown off course.
And the government seems really quite secretive, doesn't seem prepared to share with any of us what its thoughts are on going forward. Mm-hmm. Occasionally you get some spectacular mishaps like David Davis appearing in front of the Select Committee, which revealed a few thoughts on where the government's thinking was. But until the point comes when they actually start negotiations, presumably, well, they can no longer hide it anymore. Presumably, it'll be leaking like a sieve out of those rooms.
I agree with Deirdre. I mean, the fact the Select Committee chairs have come together in the liaison committee because we're all getting no answers on some things in committee. And we're trying to pull together as a group of Select Committee chairs to say to government, you've got to give us more information for us to do our job properly to help you to do your job.
I don't think the government's been deliberately secretive. I think an awful lot of this is incredibly new. As we know, the government wasn't particularly prepared for a no result, and therefore the early stages of work might have been done sometime before, but it had to be done sort of after the referendum. And I think, in all fairness, this is a government that's been finding its feet, now is in a situation where a certain amount has got to be held confidentially for negotiations. But as I said, I think an engagement with Parliament after the election and after the Prime Minister, who is seeking to secure a result that will give her the means in which to go forward with a powerful position of negotiation, I think the inclusion then will be very important. And I suspect the House will be keen to see that.
Alistair Bay, I mean, you're a former Foreign Office minister. Are your colleagues simply being unrealistic to think that the House of Commons can be a player in international negotiations?
I think I've got some colleagues who clearly believe that this was a much more straightforward issue than it's going to turn out to be. I think there are still some in the media and outside who believe it's all about us and all we have to do is bang the table in certain directions and things will fall into place for the United Kingdom. That's not true. I don't think the Prime Minister believes that for a moment. But in a way, the election clears the decks for that, the referendum decision, the election. Then we can get on with the reality of negotiations. And I think a certain amount of openness about that will be really important.
I'm quite intrigued by how the election will clear the decks, because up till now, it seems to me the government's had a pretty clear run at all pieces of legislation that have come before the House of Commons around Brexit. So I'm still not convinced that she really needed to call this general election for that purpose.
I think the answer to the question is a domestic one, in that the Prime Minister's majority is not large. Yes, she was able to get through everything in the House of Commons, that's quite true. But if you analyse the Conservative Parliamentary Party, there have been a variety of different views about Europe. Some of them are quite strongly held by different groups. A larger majority enables the Prime Minister to ensure that small groups within the party don't actually run the negotiations. And I believe if those who voted Remain, like me, and some of those who could be classed as very determined Brexiteers, if they recognise that our role now is to get behind the Prime Minister in these negotiations, I think that's what I meant by clearing the decks and moving forward.
It's not just about Theresa May having a mandate, as she likes to talk about it. There are going to be 650 members of Parliament in the next Parliament who will all individually have their own mandates. So the question of mandate is not a straightforward one in the way that Mrs. May seems to see it. Our system is parliamentary, it's not presidential.
Can I just widen this out a little bit? Because although it's been a short parliament, the shortest for 40 years, a lot of the time select committees have had an enormous amount of clout, it seems. And the Prime Minister almost seeming to have to clear the Syria intervention with Crispin Blunt, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, for example. You've seen various other committees at various different times pushing things like the sugar tax or pushing for big changes in the prison system or whatever. So they've been very, very activist. Is this purely because you've got a government with a small majority, and will select committees be back in their box if there's a government with a bigger majority come June the 9th? Meg Hillier.
I don't think so. I think that the election of chairs and the increasing collaboration, I mean, barely, you know, no week goes past when I'm not discussing with another select committee chair, and of course my committee covers the whole range of business and government, about what's going on in their committee and how we can work together. We share evidence, we share what's happened in our hearings so that people can replay that to ministers or officials. There's no way to run and hide now. If you're a government minister or an official in front of a select committee, it's not just about appearing once and surviving. We're on you and we will pursue you till we get a result.
I would agree with Meg, and actually I'm going to make Meg blush now, because I would say she's been one of the great exponents of that in this parliament. Yeah. She's been a tremendous chair. Yeah. I was on the public accounts for about a year, and she was incredibly collegiate, not just with other fellow conveners, but also just making sure that there was great cross-party work across the committee. And certainly it had a tremendous impact, I think, on various departments. I mean, some of the things like encouraging permanent secretaries to come back, for example, after 6 months to explain themselves was something that you introduced, Meg, and I think that's had a real impact on their thinking in the civil service.
Oh, you've already reminded your listeners, Mark, that I am a recovering whip, and that used to be one of the big pieces of patronage that the whips had, was membership of select committees. They could appoint and remove almost at will. Now the chairs are elected by the whole House, and the members are selected by whatever internal process there is within the different parties. And what you're seeing now is the fruits of that change coming through. It has strengthened the independence of the select committees. And to answer your question about a bigger majority, well, a bigger majority does have a difference, because it does change the balance within a committee. You would have a bigger government majority on it. But I think even within that bigger majority, you're still likely to find a bit more independence and a bit more objectivity amongst the work of the select committees.
I've been in the House for almost the entire length of life of the select committees. I came in 83, just 4 years after they were established. And I have seen them grow in authority. And I think they now have a life of their own. And I don't think that's going to be changed or diminished in any way. So regardless of majority or anything, I now think the select committees are a firm part of the agenda.
And are MPs actually becoming different creatures now? It's quite noticeable that there's often quite confessional moments in Parliament where people will talk about some horrible thing that's happened to them or their family. It might be a history of alcoholism. It might be someone committing suicide. It might be something terrible like that. But once upon a time, I don't think MPs bared their souls in the way that they sometimes do now. Thank you, Leah.
I think we do live in a different world now with, you know, 24/7 media. Social media has changed, I think, the discourse. And I think it's probably more a reflection of that than anything else, where, you know, for some people, especially the younger generation, most of their life isn't private because they put it out there themselves on social media. So I think that's possibly partly where that's happened from.
Alistair Bird, as you reminded us, you're the veteran on this panel. Have you noticed that?
Yes, I have. I think it's of tremendous value because the heartrending stories in this Parliament that we've had from those who have lost either babies or children very young and describe their experiences, I think that's really resonated with people outside who have been through those experiences themselves. And just something says, gosh, these people actually maybe do understand what it is we go through. And I think that's helped at a time when other things militate against politicians and it's easy to abuse them. One or two things make people stop in their tracks and think these are real people, like Tobias Elwood seeking to help PC Keith Palmer, things that happen in life where MPs are able to demonstrate something about their humanity.
I think you've got a combination of different forces at play here. One thing is that actually as a society we are much more open to talking about some things that would have been even 10, 20 years ago a taboo, neonatal deaths, mental illness and the rest of it. And of course Parliament is representative of the people in that respect as well. We've also though got a process point here, which is that the government no longer controls 100% of parliamentary business. There is now 25% that is down to backbenchers to control. And these debates that you're talking about are debates that when I came into the House in 2001 just didn't happen. There was not time given to them. And let me say, I think it's entirely healthy. Anything that allows people to see that somehow or another, when you become an MP, you don't just depart the human race, it's got to be good.
Westminster Hall's made a difference, hasn't it?
The
parallel debating chamber. Yeah. It's enabled more things to be brought out.
And the Backbench Business Committee has really come into its own.
And the Petitions
But also the
Petitions Committee is a
well.
Great success.
Speaker championing backbenchers to an extent that hasn't happened before as well.
Urgent questions.
It does sort of remind people of the frailty of us all as human beings. I mean, yes, we're MPs, but, you know, we are human beings as well. And the awful murder of Joe Cox, for example, was another occasion.
That was the final point that I wanted to put to you all, actually. This is a Parliament, despite being quite a short one, that's been scarred by two quite awful moments of violence. The murder of Joe Cox, the terrorist attacks only a few weeks ago. How does that change the mindset of people inside the confines of the Palace of Westminster? Is there a sense of siege?
I was just thinking when Joe Cox was murdered, I had people saying to me, does this mean you're not going to hold surgeries anymore? And, you know, I thought about it for about 5 minutes and then thought, absolutely not, because that is so important to me to be able to see people on a regular basis, have them come in, tell me their problems, and particularly having to be down here such a lot, you don't get as much contact as, say, when I was a counsellor. So, no, actually, I just figure, you know, you just go about your business. You have to. You can't allow those
I think it does forge a certain closeness among colleagues because we've gone through that. And I have to say, I went home after PC Palmer had been murdered and it was my daughter's birthday. I'd been late. I'd already missed an event. And we saw the news headlines together and we both sobbed at that point because I hadn't seen the news headlines. And she said, what if it were you? And it really brought home to me that two events, poor Joe being murdered, she's a mother like me, PC Palmer, a father of a child a bit younger than my own youngest, and it is close to home, it's where I work, and I felt then it really hit me that this affects our families as well.
Yeah.
But next day I was up working, haven't stopped surgeries, and same with Deirdre, I agree. Yeah. Being out there, publicly facing people is what this job is about, and I couldn't do this job if I didn't do it that way.
Yes.
Alistair Burr?
I think the House has been remarkably resilient. I think we have carried on. We'll never forget these events. But as colleagues have said, the determination to do the job in the way we know we must do them has been a contributing factor to us getting through this. I'm sure we all got supportive emails, messages about both events, recognising the impact upon us. And I just hope that that lingers. Sometimes that ends very quickly. But there is in this country perhaps an aggression of language now that we didn't have in the past. Mm. Social media, tweets, and many colleagues have suffered. That plays a part too, and I think we have to be very careful about language, language of respect, some of the aggressive language, sometimes in some of the newspapers. And people just have to think about the impact of this, and perhaps these events might just lead to a better discourse in the future.
It's a bit of a cliche, but we always talk about the Westminster Village. And in many ways, it is like a small community that just exists on its own. We spend a lot of time with each other. We've got our own places to eat, to drink. We've got our own policemen. We've got our own post office. It is like a village. And we react as any small community would react to an incident of that sort.
Alistair Carmichael, Meg Hillier, Alistair Burt and Deirdre Brock.
Now, there's been some last-minute bartering between the government and opposition to get a final handful of bills into law before the election campaign begins for real. So today, the controversial Higher Education and Research Bill was passed, although some peers were disappointed that they failed in the end to use it to exclude overseas students from the UK's immigration figures. The Digital Economy Bill was passed by the Lords too. The Lib Dem, Lord Fox, was concerned that it would not do enough to create fast digital connections across the UK. He likened it to repainting the house without sorting out the plumbing first. But the minister argued that if the obligations on providing super-fast broadband were set too high, there could be legal challenges which would actually delay the rollout of better connections. And so, the final ceremony to close this session of Parliament, known as prorogation, took place later in the afternoon. In a mirror of the state opening of Parliament, senior peers wear their red and ermine robes while sitting on the woolsack, and there's much doffing of bicorn hats. Black Rod, a senior officer in the Lords, is sent off to summon MPs to attend the House of Lords.
We're out.
Black Rod, open the door.
Black Rod!
Mr. Speaker, the Lords, who are authorised by virtue of Her Majesty's Commission to declare her royal assent to acts passed by both Houses and to declare the prorogation of Parliament, desire the presence of this Honourable House in the House of Peers.
The Clerk of the Crown then announces bills which are to pass into law, with the response from the Clerk of the Parliament in Norman French, La Reine la veut, meaning the Queen wishes it.
Neighbourhood Planning Act.
La Reine la veut.
Bus Services Act.
La Reine la veut.
The ceremony signifies the Queen's assent for each bill, and not long after, Parliament was officially prorogued. And so that was the end of it. Parliament is formally dissolved at 1 minute after midnight on Wednesday. That's when current MPs stop being MPs, though ministers do continue as ministers. The Queen will summon Parliament back on June the 13th, when peers and MPs will be sworn in and a Speaker elected. And the state opening of Parliament is the following week on June the 19th. But that's all from us till then. I'm Susan Hume, and I was joined by Mark Darcy. The editor was Rachel Byrne, and that was Today in Parliament.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.